From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
At its most fundamental level, I guess I always thought it meant vegetables grown in the fields of an organic farm, like in the soil, or animals raised in its pastures. But increasingly, as hydroponics have become more widespread, soil isn't always part of the organic food-raising equation. More about what organic means in a moment, but first, this message.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
Today's guest is Lindley Dixon, a Colorado-based organic farmer who's also co-director of the Real Organic Project, an advocacy organization of farmers who grow in the soil and together seek to protect the integrity of the organic label's meaning on food. Real Organic Project is holding a day-long conference October 14th in Hudson, New York, with a great lineup of presenters from the organic community, and we'll hear about that too. Hi, Lindley. Thanks for coming in from the greenhouses and the fields to help and talk to me about this. Thank you.
Hi, Margaret. I've been a longtime fan of the podcast and your writings.
Yeah, so you know, again, you'd think I would know these things, having been kind of a vegetarian most of my life and having been a consumer of organic products forever and ever and so forth, you'd think I would certainly be alerted. But until talking to you over recent years, you know, I really didn't understand the distinctions. And this is something that's not just for vegetables and herbs and so forth, but for pasture-raised for animals, for even blueberries can be done without soil. And so tell us a little about what Real Organic Project is and, you know, kind of what the foundation of it is and how it got started. What was the impetus?
Sure. Proud to do it. It's at its heart, it's a farmer-led movement. And so I'm the co-director with a Vermont tomato farmer that you may know of because he's closer to you, Dave Chapman. He's probably one of the best organic tomato farmers in the country. And he grows tomatoes under about 2.5 acres of these Dutch style glass greenhouses in the soil, which you kind of have to differentiate. Now you didn't have to under the organic standard, but in recent years, and he was the one that started to notice this because he really does sell a lot of wholesale. He was competing with tomatoes that were sort of tasteless and mealy and found out that they were hydroponic. And he thought, well, that's a mistake. And I actually met him when he had raised the issue with a bunch of other farmers, mostly in New England, but it kind of was spreading across the country that hydroponics was being allowed. And when you're an organic farmer, you're pretty much all consumed with the health of your soil. And so this really struck a chord with a lot of farmers across the country. So I met him at these meetings where we were trying to reform the organic program and make sure that organic stayed focused on soil health.
Right, because as an organic gardener for decades, you know, and kind of in my writing and in my thinking, you know, I think of that, what you just said, I think of feed the soil, not the plant, you know, that I'm building soil health, and that's the foundation from whom all blessings flow. You know what I mean? That's the basis of the whole food chain, the whole life chain, so to speak. So it surprises me that growing hydroponically would be organic. And that so the organic standard was what, from the mid 90s or something, the national standards?
Yeah. They wrote the law, the Organic Foods Production Act, in 1990, but it took 10 years to actually create standards based on that law. And it was a very democratic, farmer-led process. And so there were a lot of skeptical farmers at the beginning because the USDA hasn't always loved or supported organic, and they were nervous to hand it over to them. But because the process included this idea of a National Organic Standards Board, and there was going to be a lot of stakeholder feedback in the process, the farmers got on board. And it was in 2000 that they started implementing to kind of the national standard. Of course, there were always these, I'm sure in your area, it's the NOFAs and the MOFCAs, but there's out west, there's CCOF, they all had their own standards. And the idea was to have kind of a standard across the nation that was the same. to make a long story short, I think all the farmers came together around the hydroponic issue, but there were problems kind of from the very beginning where the USDA didn't really enforce the standards, even though the law is a really good standard. The enforcement was lacking from the very beginning, mostly around getting animals out on pasture. I mean, they were certifying these big chicken barns. So, and it's to the point where when you allow a lower standard, it really drives out the higher standard just because under the same label, it's a cheaper method of production.
Right. Of course. Of course. So, and so what you just hinted at is that this isn't just hydroponic versus in the soil for plants. It's also animals raised in barn and buildings, essentially, yeah. You know, enclosed that never are not pasture raised. And so for those of us who love going to the local providers where we live and seeing it says, you know, that it's, I mean, the words used to be things like free range or whatever, but, you know, it'll say like pasture fed or whatever it says that makes you, you always think, oh, that's better. You know, you are willing to pay the premium price because you can visualize that. And this, even though some of these animals and the eggs from chickens and some of the meats and so forth are, can be labeled organic, the animals were not living in that imagined idyllic farm right. condition at all, right? And yet they're organic.
I think yeah. Many people are surprised that we came an add-on standard. It's like, you know, if it's gone so wrong, why would we require organic certification first? But what we see with these other terms, like you mentioned, things like pasture or animal welfare, you know, it's like if you don't have a standard, it's happening to regenerative right now, then it just gets so easily co-opted. So there actually is a really good law in place. And so the idea of creating a standard would be, the hope is to actually apply pressure for reform so that we can save all this work that really farmers have worked on over the course of their lifetime.
Right. So you're a farmer, you've been an organic farmer, you're in Colorado, you raise vegetables. How big is your farm, and how long have you been doing it? Any specialties? Is there anything that you're just like a super expert in?
Well, Dave and I hit it off because we're both tomato farmers at our core. I mean, he started with oxen and every vegetable you can imagine and really specialized in tomatoes, but we still have many different crops on our farms, on our farm. But Dave actually mentored me in the last 5 years for how to grow tomatoes better in a greenhouse. And it really changed the economics
yes.
of our farm. And it's
yes.
something that I think anybody can do, actually, if they learn a few little techniques, even as a home gardener, things like grafting or even just trellising so that you're harvesting at like at eye level, that transforms really kind of the ease of how to produce tomatoes. And then also just whether or not they rot on the ground or on the plants, you know, if they split, you really can get double the yield pretty easily with some basic techniques.
So you said greenhouse, and before when you were talking about Dave Chapman's operation, you said greenhouse, or you said, actually you didn't call them greenhouses,
glass
you called
greenhouses.
Glass
yeah.
greenhouses, right.
Yep.
And so just again, so people visualize, we're talking about on top of soil. So it's to control other factors, and tomatoes in particular, I think, have a lot of issues, as we all know who grow them, with
yes.
fungal diseases and soil splash and spores moving up the ladder of the leaves from the bottom to the top, all kinds of things. And I'm totally oversimplifying, but in the more controlled environment that you're describing, and it could even be a high tunnel, I suppose, a simple, not greenhouse,
yes.
but greenhouse, we can control a little more of that. And more farmers have gone to that. And even some of my garden friends have gone to that, at least, you know, kind of trying to minimize some of the havoc. The havoc, yeah.
Even something as simple as grafting will double your yields. And that you can actually do. I do it with a little Johnny's stand, where there's a tent that goes over the seedling stand. And so some of these techniques are actually pretty easy to adapt on your own gardens.
So you're grafting the tomato, the variety of tomato you wish to eat, to harvest, mm-hmm. onto a rootstock that is sturdier And more resistant to problems? Is that what you're doing?
Resistant to problems, but also just meant to grow really big and strong.
Okay. So
some
both
of the roots, right. Just kind of, yeah, get a much bigger area in the soil.
Yeah. So, right. Okay. And so as a longtime organic farmer, you know, and we both agreed that sort of feed the soil, not the plant is the foundation of organic agriculture, whether in a garden setting or a farm setting. But are there other things that you would say to this audience listening, other, you know, who are home gardeners principally, that are like the foundational principles that you follow, that work for you, the kind, whether the littler hints like the specific one you just spoke about say grafting, or that you're growing in a greenhouse, but other things that you think are really foundational to success in organic growing?
Yeah. You know, Dave always told me it's not any one tip, but it's the culmination of all of my knowledge that makes this all work. But one that really stuck with me is he taught me to actually use my compost applications, is apply them every 2 to 3 weeks from a bucket, just kind of sprinkle the compost right on top of the drip lines is how we irrigate our tomatoes because of all that soil splash.
Right.
So instead of adding all the compost at the beginning of the season, you can, which might create an anaerobic environment depending on how hot your compost is, but really just sprinkling it on top of the drip lines every couple of weeks creates kind of an even release from the compost of nutrients. Huh. I remember Elliot Coleman, who's an advisor to our project, and I got to meet him. He gave me the very best definition of organic farming that I've ever heard. And it was so simple, so it just really stuck. He said that organic farming is as simple as adding organic matter to the soil. Hmm. And I mean, that's just, you know, says it all, because if that's happening, you're mitigating the need for any of these outside fertilizers and even pest control. Because if you're paying attention to the soil, and organic matter really kind of locks up and slow releases nutrients. So that way, you know, if you, I'm sure you've noticed, Margaret, if you apply too much nitrogen, it really, the aphids come, the insects come. So that attention to kind of how slowly those nutrients are released, that is sort of the prevention that organic farmers, and there's some insurance in that organic matter, that it'll be released over time. So you have a lot more flexibility. You can get things wrong in the organic matter, kind of changes it for you, so it ends up working out correctly. So right. I think that definition, if you can keep that in mind, I mean, it's organic farming, the farming of carbon, right? Organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon. So thinking about all of that organic matter, that's what organic farming is.
So Elliot Coleman, you said, and he's an advisor to Real Organic Project. And a lot of us gardeners know him from his really important books. One of the early voices for organic, not just farming, but also for gardening. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And to tell us about his tactics and, you know, so he wrote really, really important works and has been, you know, an inspiration to many over the years. So no surprise that he's on board with this. This is, So you said you just used the phrase paying attention, and not in the same way I'm going to ask you about it, but I also think that's one of the things is that, and I use this expression, you can't set it and forget it. You can't just, with living things, when you are the steward of living things, you can't just stick them in the ground or sow the seed and then walk away and go back at harvest time. You know, it's, yeah. I think vigilance is another really important skill and tactic of an organic grower, especially, you know, who's not going to be able to rush in with some remedy, quote unquote, you know, some chemical remedy if things start to go off. But watching, I think, is really important. And I assume that you have a vigilance practice.
You there do, at the or farm. You're getting trouble, right?
Yes. Yes. So to me, that's another one of the things.
I think, you know, scale is kind of an interesting issue in organic. They've never really limited scale, but I think inherently it is scale limiting because, you know, we talk of as farmers, the eyes to acres ratio. You can't let the acreage get so big that you're, you know, if you're a conventional farm and you miss a pest outbreak in the corner of a field 100 miles away or 100 acres away, you know, you're all right. You can just go get a pest, you know, a spray for that pest. But as an organic farmer, you don't have that as kind of a, you know, an easy fix. So you do, you have to check. We actually had a whitefly outbreak this year and we've never had that. Mm. You got to catch it early and they can take out an entire crop. And so we've got biocontrol that is part of that process. You put little sticky tape over the areas or right in the regions where you see the outbreak, and you have to get on it early because we actually have different greenhouses and some of them are hoop houses. In our hoop house, we missed it and it took the crop out. And in our greenhouse, we were able to catch it and use this biocontrol process. And so, yeah, just keeping on top of it, you know, we don't have that easy fix. So we lose our crop if we miss it. And that's kind of part of why biodiversity is so key, because if we do lose something, because it's a particularly bad year for a pest, then, you know, we're not really, like, our business doesn't depend on needing a spray. We can just let that crop go and it's a good year for something else.
Right, right. Yeah. So, I mean, tomatoes, it sounds like you've upped the game and you've figured out ways to get around some of the primary issues with those. I mean, I feel like, are there other crops that are important ones in your offerings, or is that the primary driver of
the
business?
That's the one that certainly makes it all work, financially, but I am experimenting because in the greenhouses, you can't grow your own fertility. We really depend on compost for our fertility. But out in the fields, I've been experimenting lately with how to have our aisles so that they're creating the fertility for the rows. And that's been really fun to kind of watch, because what's happened is the aisles have sort of expanded a little bit more. And our whole kind of cropping technique has changed. And what we do is we mow the aisles into the rows, and then we'll incorporate that kind of green manure, is what farmers call it, that kind of cover crop.
Of course.
That into the rows. But you don't want to mow them all at once, because you want some of them to flower. And the biocontrol that comes in on the flowering weeds from the aisles is pretty awesome to watch. So as long as you can kind of keep that biology cycling, that's something that's new on our farm that I've been sort of obsessed with, because if you can grow your own fertility on the farm, then you don't have to worry about kind of any, you know, you bring stuff in off the farm and it might have herbicide carryover, or there are environmental issues with where it was harvested or mined. So it's kind of this, the highest level of environmental stewardship is if you can figure out how to grow your own fertility on the farm. And I haven't perfected it. I don't know if I ever will, but it's been fun to try.
So that's interesting. So you're, in a sense, growing some of your cover crops in, as you say, in the aisles, in between the rows, like where machines would walk. Yeah. Walk or drive. Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting.
It's beautiful, because then the tractor wheels are always going over pasture.
Uh-huh.
They're on bare dirt.
Right.
There's resiliency there, but you also don't lose any space really to grow that fertility, because it's actually kind of, you know, where you're walking anyway, and you don't have to weed it too. That's a beautiful thing.
Interesting. So do you, in doing the Real Organic Project, do you find that when you have events like you're having one, actually not far from me in Columbia County, New York, in mid-October, and we'll give information with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com with, you know, the link to your website and also to the specifics about this event, which has a great lineup of speakers and so forth. But do you find that when you go out and you present and talk to people about Real Organic, are there some, like, astonished, is it the same couple of questions every time, and the same like aghast looks about the same aspect of it? Or because for me, one of the things was, and I mentioned it at the very beginning quickly, the fact that blueberries were being grown hydroponic. I mean, even woody plants, do you know what I mean? Even like shrubs that, because to me, speaking of beneficial insects and having an environment, a biodiverse environment, I mean, blueberries, wow. Like, those are some of my helper plants here in the garden. You know, they attract pollinators and they just do all kinds of good things besides making blueberries.
Yeah, and they live probably 40, 50 years, right? So it'd be odd to think of it as hydroponic.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we have an amazing podcast. And so everybody is in a different level of understanding of these issues. And so I would recommend listening to that podcast if you're confused by this and want to understand it better. And Hugh Kent, who's a blueberry farmer, he has a couple of them. His most recent was a talk at EcoFarm. And actually, if you can watch that one, because you can see his slides, it's pretty shocking, the environmental impact of these hydroponic farms. And, you know, they're really plastic on plastic on plastic, these big sandwiches and all the fertilities coming in. And then the plants are done in 4 to 5 years. The entire right. plastic farm gets thrown out and then they start it over again. So the environmental impact is pretty severe. And it's, yeah, it'll help you understand kind of the way an organic farmer thinks. We interview a lot of farmers, but, you know, there's chefs and authors on there too. It just helps you kind of think more holistically how farmers, organic farmers, are thinking about their farm. And it might help you understand why things like grazing and soil health are so important to us.
Yeah. So you have what, maybe 1,200 farms
That's
who
right.
are members of the Real Organic Project at this point, all in different areas of the country. Is that right?
Yeah. And these are farmers that are agreeing to another inspection on top of the USDA inspection.
Right.
Part of this program. So that's pretty astonishing to see how quickly it's grown in such a short time. Farmers get this. They understand the need for this.
So in the last 3-4 minutes, I wanted to ask you more about that. So I think at the conference in October, you're going to do one of the presentations. And I think you're going to talk about kind of what sets these member farmers apart and how can consumers support them and support the work of this organization. So tell us a little bit about sort of the highlight reel of that, that part of the conference. Yeah.
Yeah, I think most people would just want to hear kind of what we're ensuring if you look for this sticker. And so, you know, we did talk about the soil health and pasturing, but we also ensure that the whole farm is meeting those higher organic practices, because there is a lot of fraud that happens when you have a split operation. So you have some conventional production and some organic. And one of the biggest ones, there was just a few acres of organic production that had an organic seal. And then a lot of conventional stuff went through that organic certificate. So the whole farm needs to be organic. There are worker welfare protections. So this is really just kind of pushing the bar forward. Really, when the farmers stop being involved and just handed it over to the USDA, that whole concept of continuous improvement under the seal that we really had with our regional chapters went away. So we're just trying to bring that back and continue to improve over time.
And how do consumers, non-farmers, how do consumers engage with Real Organic Project? I mean, I assume it's a nonprofit, so you probably have donors. And do people just attend your events and support these farmers? And
we've got this great website. So visit the website. You can see the conference that's at Churchtown Dairy on October 14th,
sure.
first thing. And then there's we're actually releasing a new website in about a month, but you can go now. There's a ton of videos.
Yes.
The podcast, the letters. We have something called Real Friends, where it's a book club. But part of this group is to ask eaters to help the farmers along. And that might mean just telling your friends about your favorite podcast episodes or going to your co-op and saying, do you have any real organic products? So that hopefully your farmers locally can get a little bit of an edge, because they're really having trouble getting markets and the price point is so low. So you can help them out by requesting real organic products in your stores too.
Okay. So in the last minute or two, I just wanted to ask, so you're in Colorado, and what zone are you technically where you farm?
Oh gosh, there are so many microclimates. So I would say we're a 6-something, but
yeah, okay.
It depends on the year, and climate change is creating all kinds of changes.
It is. So it is.
I don't even know anymore.
Yeah. So you talked about tomatoes. So are you like winding down your season, or do you do off-season crops as well? Do you have?
We are. So the funny thing here is we actually, it doesn't get really in the single digits as far as cold, but our season's really short because we're high elevation. So
right.
we will get our first frost probably this weekend.
Okay.
It's always around the third week of September. And our last frost is oh gosh, like in the middle of June sometimes. So we have about a 90-day window, which is
wow.
Wild. And we get these kind of passing hailstorms too, because that's what happens in the mountains. Yeah. So that's why I have all of these different levels of tunnels. And even out in the field, we have a lot of remay and, you know, ways to protect the crops out in the field.
Interesting. Well, Lindley Dixon, who's co-director of the Real Organic Project, thank you for kind of giving us a 101 on this subject. Very, very counterintuitive, you know, to think that organic doesn't mean grown in the soil, but thanks for alerting us to that. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.